From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farai Chidea. On today's Reporters Roundtable, we'll be talking about the implications of down-ticket losses for the GOP, the latest this week in Mississippi. We'll also talk about a very curious Obama T-shirt and a climate of racism that some Obama campaign workers have been reporting in Indiana. Big news out of the California Supreme Court yesterday, which overturned the ban on gay marriage. But will that be the last word on this debate in the Golden State? And finally, we'll look at a tragic police shooting in Inglewood, California, near Los Angeles, that left one young, unarmed black man dead, but has not been talked about very much in the national media. Joining us are Mara Schiavocampo, NBC News digital reporter, Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the online news journal BlackAgendaReport.com, and Deidre Childress, editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Hey there.
Hello, Tony.
Mara, nice to have you again, and I'm going to get your name clear this time, I promise you.
Okay.
I've been working on it. I'm going to get it. But let's talk about the election first. Tom Davis, the Virginia Republican congressman, said that GOP loss in the Mississippi special election, which was the third Republican loss this year, makes this the worst political atmosphere, these are his words, for the GOP since Watergate and far more toxic than 2006. Mara, what do you make of these results?
Well, it's the canary in the coal mine, or at least that's what they're afraid of, and they're very open about the fact that this is causing great concern for them. Nobody is trying to sugarcoat this. It causes a couple problems for them. First of all, this was their strategy. The strategy that they attempted in some of these special congressional races, which was linking Obama with the Democratic candidate in conservative districts, this was the strategy they were hoping they could ride on through November. They're seeing that it's not working, so they have to try to come up with another strategy. And another thing that's come to light that maybe they had or had not considered is the amount of African-American turnout. And so they're seeing now that the African-American turnout is really high. That's helping the Democratic candidates. In some cases, it may even be a backlash against the attempt to link Obama with these candidates, and people are coming out to vote and saying, no, we don't buy that. So it just created a lot of problems for them. Now they have to figure out how they're going to proceed in November to not suffer huge losses.
Bruce, can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm hearing an echo, but I'm not hearing anything else.
You're not hearing the other? Yeah, we'll try to get that worked out technically. But if you can hear me, let me at least put this question to you. How could the Republicans not be aware of the possibility of these losses, assuming that they were not?
Well, I'm sure they are, but they're stuck with the hand they've got to play, and that's that. The other part of this, though, is that bad news for Republicans is not necessarily good news for Democratic voters.
What do you mean?
The Republicans tried in this case to use their national strategy against Obama, against a local candidate, and that just doesn't always work. This local candidate, by the way, though, is a relatively right-wing Democrat, anti-choice. I don't know if he's going to join the Blue Dogs, but if he does, he'll be another pro-war, pro-warrantless wiretapping, pro-torture Democrat. Yeah, we need a lot more of those, don't we?
Well, Deidre, let me put this to you. How much of this do you think these losses can be placed on the shoulders of the president, President Bush, who right now is suffering through a 69% disapproval rate?
I think a lot of it can, because I think that the GOP and a lot of politicians have really underestimated how unhappy our citizens are right now. I don't think they realize what it's like to go to the gas pump and fill your truck up for $60 or $70, or to go to the grocery store and be short on money to feed your family, to look out into the world and see that we're losing a war, and that, you know, their candidates saying, well, I might be able to end this in 2013. I might be able to get this this war taken care of after I have my first term. So I think one of the things that I've noticed is certainly how much the politicians in general are underestimating how unhappy our citizens are.
Let's move on to another topic. A Washington Post story earlier this week described racist incidents faced by the Obama campaign people in the state of Indiana. Campaign headquarters vandalized, racial slurs hurled at canvassers. There has not been a lot of coverage of this alleged hostility towards Obama campaign workers so far. But Bruce, coming to you first, there is a bar owner in Georgia that I understand in your neck of the woods who is selling T-shirts with the likeness of Curious George munching a banana and it reads, Obama in 88, the owner of the bar says it's cute. Others say it's just racist. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen that, but this bar is in a place right next door to downtown Marietta, and I drive by it 3 or 4 times a week. I meant to drive by there today and see what the racist message of the day is. They change it frequently. There have been many anti-Hillary messages there and a couple and anti-immigrant messages. The guy is just famous for this kind of nonsense. As a black person living in the South, there's a certain amount of white noise that you just put up with. You drive by a business that flies Confederate flags out front or has this racist stuff out in the front. You just know that they're not talking to you, and you keep driving.
Well, Mara,
the Obama campaign makes really good use of this stuff, though. Paradoxically, they use it to fire the troops up, and I don't know that it does the racists any good.
Well, let me bring Mara in on this, because some have suggested, as you almost just did, that the Obama campaign is not making a lot of reporting on incidents like this. Transcending race may be difficult if these things do become a part of the ongoing dialogue. What would be the logic behind how Obama's campaign would strategize using or not using these racially insensitive incidents?
Well, I think they don't want to use it. That's the strategy. They're going to try to downplay it as much as possible because they don't want this campaign to be about race. And Obama has built his campaign on a theme of bringing people together. And if you're talking about people who are vandalizing the campaign office or saying awful racial slurs to his campaign workers, that's an issue of divisiveness. And so I think that they're probably intentionally trying to downplay it and not mention it because it doesn't speak to the larger narrative of unity that they've been trying to build all along.
Deidre, let me ask you, because presidential campaigns are notorious for bringing out the worst in people in terms of what they say about the opponent, both in advertising on air, in print, and in some of the kinds of incidents that we are seeing now. But does the racial element make this any different in your view?
I think it does. I think what it points out is that we are still dealing with a lot of people who are very desperate, very unhappy with where they are in their own stations. And I think what's going to be interesting is to see how people deal with the racial reality that's coming on all of us. When you look at our children and you see that 44.5% of the children born in this country are children of color, you have to realize that there's going to be a point where we're all going to have to deal with a different racial reality. And I think that's what pushes this for a lot of people.
I want to move on to yet another topic in the time that we have left. We had yet another tragic police shooting, leaving a young unarmed black man dead early Sunday morning in Inglewood, which is a city southwest of Los Angeles. Interesting, though, that this incident has gotten very little coverage outside of the L.A. area. Deidre, you are in Philadelphia, a city currently reeling from a recent police misconduct incident that was captured on video from a news helicopter. How do you size up the national press coverage of officer misconduct, and what's your reaction to having perhaps not even heard about the shooting in Inglewood?
Well, I think on the East Coast, we hear about things more frequently because one of the problems with news coming out of California is the news cycle. I think the other thing is because we're in the Northeast Corridor, we get a lot of East Coast activism. But I think in the way that the bloggers brought the Gen 6 issue to the forefront, I think that that can happen in California if enough people realize that something happened there that is upsetting and that is something that we all need to address regarding police. Right here in Philadelphia, in fact, today, they announced that they had a different account of the police beatings that we had 10 days ago. They said that, you know, there were 3 suspects and a 4th man who emerged from a car. The 4th man fired shots. They pursued the 3 men who were eventually beaten on tape. And now today, they say there was no 4th man. So, again, we have to look at these things in a larger picture. And when we bring them all together, we realize that there's so much work to still be done between citizens and police officers, and in particularly in terms of our young men being out there and being, you know, beaten or shot without any weapons on their person at all.
Well, Mara, is it possible that we are becoming desensitized to this because it happens with such regularity?
I don't think that that's what's happening in this particular case. I agree with Deirdre that I think that we could be just seeing the beginning of this, that we may see bloggers talking about it as more information comes out. If it comes out that this really truly is the injustice that it seems to be on the surface, that we'll start to hear more about it. The other thing to keep in mind, because I hadn't heard about this until your producer told me about it, and so I took a look back at the Newsweek to see, well, what else was happening while we were missing this story. Monday you had China's earthquake. Tuesday was the West Virginia primary. Wednesday was Edwards' endorsement. I mean, this hasn't been a slow news week. So that's something to consider as well, in that, you know, there are huge stories that are happening right now that are taking our attention away from the smaller but equally important ones. But I do think that we could see, hear more about this as the facts continue to come out.
I have less than a minute, Bruce. I'm going to come to you. Do you think that not hearing much about a shooting like the one in Inglewood also has to do with the fact that here in Los Angeles, for example, the black population is 6-7%. It's so small that there doesn't seem to be the groundswell voice that you can get in larger eastern cities that have big black populations.
That could be true, but this is also a national problem, and this will get me in trouble with some Obama supporters, but I think he ought to step up, and he should have, if he had made some kind of real statement in the wake of the Sean Bell verdict that the law is going to be equally enforced for everybody under my Justice Department, then perhaps police would already be looking at the practices differently, and maybe this incident might not have happened.
All right, we'll have to stop it there. Thank you very much, Bruce, Mara, and Deirdre. Mara Schiavocampo, a digital reporter for NBC News. Bruce Dixon, managing editor of BlackAgendaReport.com, who joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Radio. Deirdre Childress is editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine. She joined us from Audio Post in Philadelphia. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Inmates living in confined spaces can put a magnifying glass on racial tensions. Last month at the Florence Penitentiary in Colorado, two prisoners died in a riot triggered by racial slurs. Reports say a group of white supremacist prisoners sparked the violence after they aimed slurs at some black inmates. We continue our look at the criminal justice system today with an examination of racial tensions behind bars. In a few moments, we'll talk to two advocates who have seen this issue firsthand in the prison system. But now, we are joined by Lee Baca. He is the sheriff for Los Angeles County, which has long had its share of dealing with racial incidents in its jail system. Welcome, Sheriff.
Thank you, Tony. Good morning.
You oversaw the deadly racial riots in the L.A. jails 2 years ago in 2006. How big a factor, Sheriff, is race inside the jails and prisons?
It's very substantial, and unfortunately, it's a few inmates that want to foment this kind of behavior where black inmates, no matter what their status is, they don't even have to be gang members, are being attacked by gang members who are in the county jail, and then these gang members are earning credits. When they go to state prison, they'll be able to be viewed as loyal soldiers to the Mexican-American gangs that are in the state prison system. So the theory behind what they do is they attack any black inmate. The dorms automatically divide under racial separation, and then the big fight is on, and many innocent people get hurt, including Latinos as well.
Going back to 2006, you ordered prisoners to be segregated despite an earlier ruling by the state Supreme Court that such segregation was unconstitutional. Why did you do that, and what were the consequences?
Initially, I did it because it made common sense, and then, of course, inmates, both Latino inmates and African-American inmates, were asking that this be done. What was interesting is that the Latino inmates that were wrapped up in this unwittingly, meaning that they didn't want to do any fighting, but knew that the culture there was that if they didn't fight, then other Latino inmates would jump them. They were sending messages to me saying, we need to separate each other for a period of time until this thing cools down.
You've decried the lack of funding, overcrowding, the high inmate-to-guard ratio. What's needed now to stop this, or can it be stopped?
Well, I believe it can be stopped. It needs to be managed properly. We find that it's the younger inmates who are impulsive and want to carry on orders from state prison gang members to attack, in this case, African-Americans, no matter whom. And these people, the younger ones, are more susceptible to that. So you got to segregate them from the older population. And at the same time, you have to have stronger supervision so that any slight indication of something about to erupt, you've got to intercept it and prevent it from happening in the first place. And so we have ebb and flow in our county system where we can go for months and years without a problem. But then, again, the Southsider group from Los Angeles, which has essentially a lot of Latino members, will try to exercise dominance in the jails as a message to all African Americans that there's more of us and we can dominate the situation in the jails, and we're going to dominate the situations in the streets.
We're talking with L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca. Sheriff, is there much difference as far as racial issues are concerned between inmates in, let's say, county jail as opposed to state or federal prisons where the inmates are serving longer terms and there are more of them?
Well, there is a slight difference. You know, the transient nature of the county jails is that inmates have access to each other much easier than in a state prison system. And at the same time, the state prison system is a long-term incarceration, and they're more calculated when they're going to do a hit. Whereas in a county jail, they can hit at any time and be spontaneous and virtually disrupt the entire environment in a jail without a real comprehensive plan, whereas in state prisons, it's more calculated.
Now, in California, particularly in Los Angeles, we have talked a lot about the tensions between Latinos and blacks. We haven't said very much about tensions between blacks and whites or Latinos and whites. How much of that is there?
Well, there is definitely tensions in the gang environment, particularly. Now, what's interesting is that the 99.999% of Latinos and African Americans get along just well. But then you have this element of gangs fighting for turf on the streets over drugs, and of course they have their gangs to back up their assertions of power. So we really are very concerned that the gang shootings on the street are often, not often, but I would say have in the past, where certain Latino gang members have shot African Americans who are not involved with the gangs. The prime example is Jameel Shaw, who was one of our star football players at Fresh Hill High School.
Final thing before we let you go, Sheriff, is this. Los Angeles gets a great deal of media attention with regard to this issue, but it does happen in other parts of the country. Is it worse here in California than it is, let's say, in the East or in the South or in the Midwest in terms of racial tension inside prison and jail walls?
Well, I can't speak for the rest of the nation, but I know that California does a lot. The state prisons do quite a bit to manage its population so that this gang conflict does not erupt into deadly violence. But here in the county jail, we have suffered the most in Los Angeles over racial tensions, but particularly, as I said, precipitated by a few gang members who understand prison culture and county jail culture, and they know that they can disrupt the entire living environment and cause for people who don't want to fight with each other have to fight with each other, and thereby it is a problem.
Sheriff Baca, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Lee Baca is the sheriff for Los Angeles County. To continue our look at racial tensions in the prison system, we turn now to Skip Townsend, a community intervention specialist at the Los Angeles-based organization called Second Chance at Loving Life. He joins me here at the NPR studios in Culver City. And Robert Richardson, he is the program director for Emmanuel Community General Services in Portland, Oregon. Gentlemen, welcome to the both of you.
Thank you.
Skip,
thank you.
Let me start with you, because you just heard L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca on how he has managed the L.A. County jails and what goes on there. You spent some time there, quite a bit, as I understand it, both in the 1980s and again as recently as 2004. The way the sheriff laid it out in terms of racial tensions and fighting, is that how it is?
I don't believe anybody could have said it better. He was right on point with the domination as far as the Latino Americans trying to dominate, as far as who can use the phone, what days you watch certain TVs, who has to clean up. It's a large influx of Hispanics as opposed to a smaller amount of African-Americans.
Now, one of the things that he said before I go to Robert to talk to him is that, these are his words, 99.9% get along well. It's just that little fraction that bring the gang life from the streets into the jails and prisons and continues it there and, in fact, escalates it there.
I must have misunderstood, because I believe that he was talking about 99% on the streets that get along well. But in the prison system, in the jail system, it's not that way. It's a tension that is immediate. As soon as incarceration, as soon as being incarcerated in L.A. County Jail, the tension is there. So it's not getting around there. The guy who might be my friend on the street, I can no longer be friends with him inside of L.A. County Jail.
Now, let me come to you, Robert. You did some time in Arizona in a prison there. How does the experience that we have been talking about here in California compare to what you experienced in Arizona?
Well, it's quite similar. I think without a doubt that the racial tension, because the Latino population is swelling and has a great deal of influence in the prison system in Arizona, it is there all the time. I think that ethnic groups hang together largely based on protection because of the tension is always, that could always explode at any given time.
Is it more because of race, Robert, or is it because of overcrowding and that it's a space issue as much as anything else?
Well, prison is territorial. Space by its nature certainly could have something to do with it, but I think that the conditions and time has to do. I mean, if you put 6,000 men or 5,000 men with an average time of 15 to 20 years doing that, that's not going to be a nice prison. The way offs of what I have to do to keep myself together or have any buy-off to making any sense to stay in order is very limited.
Well, Skip,
so tension is a...
Go ahead. Finish your thought.
Intention is always on the rise.
Skip, is there a situation in prison between blacks, whites, Latinos, whomever, where race actually is transcended, where it's not the issue?
Well, prison is a lot different than L.A. County Jail. I just want to say that. It's a lot more structured. It's a lot more disciplined. An individual who is disrespectful to another race in prison will be dealt with immediate for disrespecting another race, where in jail it would be laughed at, and if you guys want problems, then a riot will ensue. But prison is set up as sort of as little cities. These are little small communities with inside the gate, so they don't want any negative look from the staff or the COs, because they want to continue to do whatever's going on in there that, you know, they don't want to be disrupted. So, of course, there's a lot more discipline in prison than in jail. So,
But is there any activity, even in jail, that transcends race? I don't know, church, anything like that?
Yeah, there are a few programs. As a matter of fact, I applaud Sheriff Baca. He has several different programs in there that offer life management skills, and you'll see African-Americans and Latinos together come, and they have a low recidivism rate as well for offering programs like that.
One of the things, Robert, that I asked the sheriff was about Latino and black conflicts tend to happen where Latinos and blacks are located, and right now that's largely in the southwestern part of the country. In terms of racial violence, though, in other parts of the country, if you know, are the issues the same even between other ethnic groups?
Well, I don't speak as an expert in that regard, but I do believe that, as Gibson said, there's a lot of things that are centered around the way in which a man is ushered into the prison system. And somewhat saying that you have a chip on the shoulder because we realize that there has been not an equal playing field of the justice system in the way in which sentences are given. And so, therefore, certainly I believe that there could be a tension that quarters itself into other parts of the country based on what we just got through with the federal laws that changed rock cocaine sentencing versus powdered cocaine sentences based on classism more than racism. So, yeah, I do believe that there's certainly going to be pockets of frustration that's always going to be gauged. And if I got 15 years for something that my counterpart of another ethnic group got 5, well, that already has an implication of I'm less than.
Now that both of you are out and both of you are actively involved in trying to do positive work, you've tried to work with at-risk populations, Skip. Tell us what you think the biggest issues are.
Well, some of the biggest issues are these people are coming from dysfunctional families. I myself didn't realize that I came from a dysfunctional family. And if I have these conditions that I'm surrounded in, I create them as being normal. See, once I normalize the fact that I've dehumanized myself, I've dehumanized the people around me, then I have no value for life. I have no value for education. I have no value for society. And what society would like for us to do is to change the mindset of these individuals, but at the same time, society isn't changing their perception of these individuals. So there's no jobs when they get out of jail. There is no rehabilitation in the rehabilitation center. So what do they have to offer them? We're putting them, placing them back in a cesspool, back right in the same conditions and dysfunction that they come from.
Well, what do you tell, Robert, the people on the outside about, A, staying out, and B, if you do go in, what you have to do to survive while you are in, particularly given the racial tensions that we have been discussing so far?
Well, you know, certainly preparation for prison is one of the things that not at the top of the list, but after a person has got incarcerated and finds himself in a difficult situation, there's such a wide brush across the country. Certainly in Portland, Oregon, there has been a real partnership in of most crimes that are going federal. And I tell these guys mostly in the sense of saying that while you're doing this, I mean, you might have failed in Portland and you might find yourself in Kentucky or you might find yourself in South Dakota. And sometimes that's by design. If you take a black gang member and you put him in a different culture, well, he wasn't getting visits in the local jail in his own city. So now that there's an airplane between him and a possible visit, that changes the whole dynamics. And that's what one of the things I would say. But those that I have a transition program, and it's about going home versus getting out. And the methodology of that is understand that going home is ownership. Getting out is a rental. So we realize that as we scan this country that most of our homeowner property is a lot have a greater value. And so I'm saying to these guys that you cannot use an excuse that I can't get a job, I can't do this, as an alternative to try to turn yourself around into crime. But you have to use the latitude of the things in which you have built to make yourself available. And that may mean leaving the state in which you were originally arrested in.
This is
advocating for that.
Final thing I have, we have less than a minute, Skip, I'm going to bring it to you, and that's this. Is there something that works inside the prison system or inside the jail system to ease that racial tension? And if there is such a thing, what is it?
I don't believe there is right now. I believe the scales are unbalanced. As long as you have a 100-bed module and you have 80 of them being occupied by Latinos and 20 of them being occupied by African Americans, then the scales are unbalanced. And the only way I see to straighten out the problem is to balance the modules, balance the number of inmates. You find when you have a larger number of African American in the same cells with the same amount of Latinos, then these riots don't take place.
Skip, Rob, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Robert Richardson is the program director for Emmanuel Community General Services. He is also the chairman of the African American Council to the Portland Police. He joined us from the studios of Palatine Recordings in Portland, Oregon. And Skip Townsend is a community intervention specialist at Second Chance at Loving Life here in California. He joined me at our studios at NPR West. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes.
Great day, the righteous marching.
Great day,
oh, God's gonna build our Zion's
walls.
Great day, the righteous marching.
Great day,
oh, God's gonna build our Zion's
walls.
It's been more than a century since the Fisk University Jubilee Singers started performing Negro spirituals and slave songs. The songs were an expression of deeply rooted religious beliefs and faith. Today, the Fisk Singers are still spreading the songs of enslaved Africans nationwide, and they are celebrated in a new show called Sing Jubilee, the Story of the Fisk Jubilee Singers. With us today is Rick Sperling, founder and CEO of the Mosaic Youth Theater in Detroit, which is staging the play, and also with us is Sing Jubilee playwright Oyamo. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Rick, let's start with you. You founded the Mosaic Theater Ensemble 15 years ago. Why'd you do that?
Well,
I really saw a tremendous need for a program like this. I was an artist in residence in the Detroit Public Schools, and more than 90% of the schools had no drama programs. Very few had music programs. And this is a community that brought us Motown and brought us some of the greatest actors and musicians. And after my experience in the schools and seeing how hungry these young people were for this, I decided we needed our own company, our own youth theater company. What I didn't expect was that young people would come from all over metropolitan Detroit and from 50 different schools, and the productions that we did were such a high level that they were on a professional level, and they've led us to tour our productions to Europe, to Asia, to Africa, all across the United States and Canada. So what started off as trying to fill a need has really become a great opportunity to be a world-class youth arts organization. It's been a very exciting 15 years.
Let's talk to the playwright, Oyamo. The Fisk Jubilee Singers story is a fantastic one, going way back and how they came together to save Fisk University from being closed down in Nashville, Tennessee. What inspired you to write this?
Well, you know, actually, I had at one point been working on a project about the Fisk Jubilee Singers, but it was a project that ultimately didn't go anywhere. But I had done some research, and I was absolutely fascinated and inspired by their story. It's quite fantastic how a group of young people came together at Fisk University under the direction of a man named George White. Actually, at that time, it was called Fisk Free Colored School, and it was formed originally by the American Missionary Association, which founded this school along with about 19 others. At that time, it was in 1871. The school was founded in 1876, but in 1871, this group decided that they were going to go out and try to raise money for Fisk under George White's direction and at his urging, and because essentially it was his idea. And times were quite perilous in those days to be traveling around with a white man, George White, 10 young singers. At that point in Nashville, Tennessee, and in the South in general, these thousands of northern white school teachers who came down to teach the freed people were risking their lives.
Well, let me stop you there because the story is fantastic, and we don't have a time to do all of it as we would like, but I want to play a little bit of the piece, and I want to ask you, Rick, after we hear a little bit of the show, to talk about the role that I understand that you play not only in staging it, but actually performing in it. Here's the piece. So, Rick, you had a part in it. I don't know if it was a singing part or a speaking part or both. What was it exactly?
Thankfully for the audience, it was not a singing part. I'm portraying the role of George White, the abolitionist who, as Oyamo said, went south to work with the freed people and was inspired by these young singers to tour the country to try to save Fisk. It's very interesting because there are a lot of parallels between the evolution of the Fisk Jubilee Singers and the evolution of Mosaic. Mm-hmm. These are young African-American performers who are trying to say to the world that they can do as great art as anyone. That was quite a statement to make in 1871, but it's amazing that that statement is still something that we have to work hard in 2008 for these young African-American performers to go out there. And we've performed at the White House and the Kennedy Center, and it takes a while for people to realize that these young people can do incredibly sophisticated works of theater, just like the Fisk Jubilee Singers did incredibly sophisticated pieces of music. And just to have a play written by Oyamo, whose plays have been produced all around the world, written just for Mosaic, I think speaks to the level. But it was our 15th anniversary, and we thought it was something special for me to act on stage with our young people.
Well, happy anniversary, and congratulations to the both of you. Oyamo, Rick,
thank you.
We appreciate your coming on. Oyamo wrote the play Sing Jubilee, the story of the Fisk Jubilee Singers. Rick Sperling is founder and CEO of the Mosaic Youth Theater in Detroit, which is presenting the play. And now it's time to go Hollywood. Mariah and Nick are back in the news after their secret wedding. So what's next? And Michael Jackson's making headlines again, too, but not for what you might think. To figure out all the entertainment news for us, we are joined now by our contributor, Tanya Hart, who hosts the syndicated radio show Hollywood Live with Tanya Hart. Hey, Tanya.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing just fine.
Good,
so
Tony.
Let's start with this thing, the happy couple, Nick Cannon and Mariah Carey. What's
first
up with
First of all,
that?
How surprised and shocked were you? Okay?
I was a little surprised. I mean, you know, I'm not hating on him, but,
hey,
you know.
Hey, he's a smart man. Well, first of all, let me just say this about Nick. I have always liked him, and when I saw him in the movie Bobby, and realized that Harry Belafonte had taken him under his wing, I said, oh, this young man is going for the long haul here. So I have a lot of respect for him. I think he is a tremendous actor and a really nice young man. And that being said, I've known Mariah since she started her career. And in fact, a lot of times now that we're both blonde, you know, I get a lot of that. Oh, are you Mariah's sister? I'm like, yeah, baby. Give me some of that money. Anyway. So I'm very happy for them. You know, she planned this. She has this new fabulous estate in the Bahamas in Eleuthera. And she kind of sent everybody down there under the pretense that they were going to be doing a music video. And, of course, it ended up being a wedding. You know how celebrities are. They got it like that.
Right. Yes, they did.
And, of course, they started sipping Doms as soon as they got off of their Gulfstream on the runway, on the tarmac. And the party went on from there. You know, lobsters flown in their own tanks for the wedding dinner. And I understand that Mariah actually had her cake sitting next to her on the plane just so it wouldn't get messed up.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm hearing that there's more news coming from this couple.
Oh, like that she might be pregnant?
Well, sort of.
Well,
yeah.
I just figured, you know, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes Mariah with a baby carriage. I mean, you know, why else? She's 38, okay? She's never had children. Right now, one of the most important accessories in Hollywood is a child. And not saying that she would do it for that reason, even though some people do. But, hey, if you're 38, why not go out and get a 27-year-old stud? I'm right with her. I call it cougarific.
Cougarific. Speaking of that term, which has been thrown around a lot on television lately, with regard to another television personality, TV host Star Jones, and who she's been seeing, but now her soon-to-be ex-husband Al Reynolds is blogging and talking. What's that about?
Well, first of all, let me just say this. Star is in Cannes, okay, at the Cannes Film Festival, and hosted a luncheon yesterday on this fabulous yacht that is owned by her friend Denise Rich. And I hear it was just a spectacular luncheon on the yacht yesterday in Cannes. And so she's over there having a real good time. She did skip, by the way, the Kentucky Derby this year, which is one of her favorite events. And I guess she felt that she was going to be bombarded by the media. I think she should just kind of get over herself on that one. But so she's having a good time. Now, as for Al, let me just say this about Al. Al claims, and honestly, I know this to be true. When she was saying, you know, that she got rid of Al because she's more traditional and she wants a man to take care of her, Al thought he was working for her. You know, he thought that's what he was doing on the payroll. And honestly, I do know for a fact that a lot of those meetings and the stylists and all the shoots and all that stuff that was set up, especially she got this new gig on, you know, before Court TV left. You know, Al set all that up, so Al thought he was working.
Well, you know, he does say something. It's quoted here from his blog, and I'll just read it. Quote, if you think you are having a tough day, may I propose you walk in my shoes for a few hours? And I'm assuming he's referring to the many accusations about his sexuality, that he was a gold digger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He kind of has a point, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And, you know, in terms of the sexuality thing, I don't know if we want to get into that right now. I have some very strong opinions on that. However, I think that when he got into this marriage with Star, I think that they both were looking for something. I think she was looking for that handsome young prince to come riding along that she could have this fabulous wedding with. And I think he was looking for, I mean, it wasn't like this guy was a go. He had a job, okay?
Okay.
So it wasn't like he had, but he didn't have that kind of money, nor did he have that kind of power or fame. I think it was fame more than power. And you know how, Tony, you know how this whole thing is very addictive. This whole riding on that crest. And we see this happen to a lot of people. And I really believe that as long as it was fun, he was in there for the ride. And when it stopped being fun, and they went through a lot with her doing that surgery. I mean, you know, I understand he was staying out real late at night just because it was hard to deal with her. So,
well, is it a thing now when you become really big, Tanya, in the entertainment world as a singer, as an actor, as a whatever, that particularly if you're black, your wedding has to be just off the chain? Is that how it is?
Not necessarily. I think that there are some people who really want to have small, intimate ceremonies, and I think that there are a few people that do that. I mean, actually, in Hollywood, most people don't even bother to get married anymore. So, quite frankly, I was happy to see that Mariah was old-fashioned enough to do it that way, because she said that. You know, she's always been a role model to young girls, and she said, you know what, that's the way she was raised, and she doesn't believe in going out and having the child and then thinking about marriage or not thinking about marriage. So that was what she wanted to do, and so I applaud her for that. I don't know if everybody does that. I think that, you know what, if you've got that kind of money, it's like it's not even a write-off, it's a drop, you know. So you drop $1 million on your wedding when you got 245 or 300 million, you know, just sitting there waiting for you. $1 million really isn't a lot,
a
even though it seems like, yeah, it seems like it to us.
Absolutely.
But hey.
Well, let's talk about another name from the past in the news who is back in the news again, Michael Jackson. But wait, it's not what you think. His record-setting 1983 album Thriller has been added for preservation by the Library of Congress, along with those from Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Tracks of My Tears, great song, and the Headhunters album by none other than jazz master Herbie Hancock, also included in this collection going to the Library of Congress. It's apparently a part of 25 recordings that are part of the nation's effort to preserve America's oral history. That's pretty cool, huh?
Oh, I think that's extremely cool, and kudos to all of them. They all certainly deserve it. You know, one of the highlights of this year for me, I happened to be backstage with Herbie Hancock when he found out he had won the Grammy this year, which was the first time a jazz album had won a Grammy in like 43 years, you know? I told Herbie, heck, that's all of my life. I don't know about yours.
here's a trivia question for you, and I will let you go. There is a president, a former president, who is also, he's also joining this list of 25 recordings. Can you guess which president it was?
In recent history or past, is it Bill Clinton? Because I know he
Ronald
did
Reagan.
Oh, Ronald Reagan.
The music
Reagan.
Is joined by other recordings like Ronald Reagan's radio broadcast
prior
to his becoming president of the United States. So
wow.
There, a little bit of trivia that you didn't know.
I didn't.
Tanya,
I
we always appreciate having you on. Thank you
My
so
pleasure,
much.
My pleasure, Tony. You have a good rest of the day.
Joining me today, Tanya Hart. She hosts the syndicated radio show Hollywood Live with Tanya Hart.